Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundtable of the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Ryan Cunningham from KCPW, sitting in for Jennifer Napier-Pierce. This week, a national critic of the way women are portrayed in video games withdrew from a Utah State University speaking engagement after the school received violent threats. We'll talk about the fallout from the Anita Sarkeesian incident for feminism and the guns on campus debate. Plus, sparks fly in the debate between candidates for the 4th Congressional District. We'll explore the divide between Republican Mia Love and Democrat Doug Owens and get an election 2014 update. And finally, former Utah Attorney General Mark Shurtleff wants all charges against him dropped. All that and Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. Stay tuned for Behind the Headlines after the news. Welcome to Behind the Headlines. I'm Ryan Cunningham, filling in for Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Today in the program, we've got feminists and gamers and feminist gamers, an animated political debate, a critical audit, and more. Joining me in the studio this morning, Tribune editorial writer George Pyle.
Good morning.
Oh, let me turn your microphone on, actually. You want to try that again?
Good morning.
Good morning, George. Also, we have government reporters Matt Canham and Robert Gerke. Hello to you.
Hello.
Good morning, Ryan.
And education editor and first-time appearance on Behind the Headlines, Rebecca Walsh. Thanks for coming in.
Glad to be here.
And you can join us, too, listeners, if there's a news story on your mind or you want to comment or question on anything we're talking about today on the program. Send your questions and comments to the hashtag TribTalk on Twitter and Google+. Put comments at sltrib.com or call us live at 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. We're going to get right into it. First off, the GOED audit. This week, state lawmakers heard the results of an audit on the Governor's Office of Economic Development, or GOED. Robert, can we get into some? We can get into some of the details as we go, but briefly explain some of the auditor's conclusions from this audit.
Well, so a little bit of the background. GOED was created back in 2006, I believe it was, and companies can come. The goal is to try to bring high-paying jobs and, you know, companies that are looking to expand, to bring them into Utah. And so companies that say they're going to create X number of jobs, say 300 jobs, and they're going to be paying above a certain wage, they can qualify down the road for a tax break. And once they've created these jobs, they can get a tax break for them. What the auditors found, the auditors spent about 6 months looking at GOED's practices. And what they found is, while at one point GOED required very high wages for, you know, to qualify for these things, over time they've considerably lowered them from about 150% of the average wage in Salt Lake County down to about 125. And they also started counting health benefits toward that. So what you end up with is a situation where some of the jobs that are being created can actually be underneath the, below the county average wage. So you're creating lower paying jobs than they ever intended to be created. And GOED's explanation for this was, well, you know, the economy tanked in 2008. We needed to kind of make sure that we were still giving incentives to these companies that were counting on them. And so they gave them a little bit of wiggle room on counting the health benefits. A couple of the other things they said, they GOED sort of was willing to kind of throw out some of the lower paying jobs that might bring the average wage down, so the companies could still qualify for the incentives that they'd been promised, or that they'd from the goals that they had negotiated. So essentially what it was, you know, in a broad sense, was that GOED was kind of fudging the numbers a little bit, or willing to cut the companies a little bit of slack to give them extra incentives that they might not otherwise have qualified for. And the reason that was troublesome to the auditor and to some of the legislators who were hearing the audit was because these companies are going to be getting tax breaks. This is going to be taxpayer money that they're going to essentially be credited for creating these jobs. And if they're not living up to the commitments they had made, then GOED's, you know, basically giving away a taxpayer plum to some of these companies that maybe don't otherwise deserve it.
So how did this audit come about? Who called for it?
Well, auditor John Dougal's the state auditor, and it's even during his time in the legislature, he was skeptical, I think, of GoEd's practices. I mean, he's sort of a free market guy, and so he thinks that the market should play itself out without this interspersion or mingling from the government. And so that was sort of the genesis of it. When he came into office, he created this performance review team. The performance audit team, and they went out and spent, they said, 4,500 hours over the last 6 months, you know, multiple people working on the audit, just kind of reviewing and going through all of GoEd's, you know, all of the contracts they made, all of the meetings that they had and things like that.
So I guess the problem that some lawmakers had and the auditors seemed to highlight in their audit was that there was a lack of There was a lack of consistency with how some of these incentives were doled out to other companies, and that might cause problems.
Yeah, it was a little loosey-goosey the way they kind of just said, you know, well, you know, we know you didn't quite make this one, but we'll go ahead and give it to you anyway. And there was an inconsistency in the incentives that companies were negotiating. One of them, for example, that happened just recently, Overstock received a certain incentive for creating 300 jobs. It was, I believe, a 10% tax credit for the 300 jobs, whereas Goldman Sachs got a 30%. So it was just in over a much longer period of time as well. They had a longer period of time to claim this. So it was, there was an inconsistency in what was being negotiated, and then there was an inconsistency in how GoEd was using the flexibility that they said they had to kind of give benefits or give incentives to companies that might otherwise not have qualified for. And without a clear set of guidelines or policies in place that would be applied across the board to all of the companies. Now, GoEd, in their response to the audit, said that, well, the legislature told us, go out and bring these companies in, and you've got a lot of latitude to do it. And, yeah, we kind of, you know, were flexible, I guess, as they put it. But, you know, that was the mandate from the legislature, and we felt like we were operating within the latitude that the legislature gave us under the statute. So they said, you know, our mission is to bring in the companies. And look, we brought in these companies. We brought in companies that have created 13,000 jobs over the period of time and generated, I believe, was $128 million in tax revenue. The other thing they point out, and this is the case, is that none of the incentives that these companies receive, the companies don't receive the incentives until they create the jobs that they've committed to creating. So if I say I'm going to create 100 jobs over 10 years, I don't get money up front. I have to show that I've created those jobs over the 10 years, and then I can get a tax credit toward the taxes I've already paid. So then it applies sort of retroactively in that regard. So GoEd says they didn't put any taxpayer money at risk. They've already collected all the taxes, and they say that there is a $3 return for every dollar incentive they give. So if they've committed to giving $600 million in incentives over the next, I believe it was 10 years, they said over that period of time they'll collect $1.8 billion in taxes. So it ends up being a benefit for the taxpayers.
And GoEd saying, look, this program is working. So really, there shouldn't be that much change brought on.
In fact, they went so far as to say, if you do change the program, it's not going to work as well, and the economy will suffer. I think there's some skepticism from some of the legislators about how they were counting the wages, like we talked about, whether they should be able to include health benefits, whether they should be giving incentives to companies that aren't paying good wages, you know, are just paying at the average or even sometimes below the average wages. So there was some skepticism about that. I think they want a little bit more oversight in it. They asked the Business and Labor Committee to look at it in the coming months, and I think during the legislative session you'll probably see some legislation come out to kind of tighten up some of the oversight and some of the rules and requirements that GoEd operates under.
Yeah, is that kind of the sense you got from lawmakers at the hearing, that they were concerned about some of the findings?
Yeah, there were some specific concerns expressed, and you know, they recognize that it puts the legislators in kind of a tough spot, because they do like GoEd, they like these business incentives, and they do like they I think by and large think that it's working. But there were some serious concerns expressed about whether they're playing too fast and loose with the authority that they've been given by the legislature, and playing too fast and loose with taxpayer dollars.
So, George Pyle from the editorial page, how big of an issue should this be during the upcoming legislative session?
Well, they're going to take a hard look at it, I'm sure. It's very complicated. I mean, the GOAD people were in to see the editorial board even before the audit came out, kind of a preemptive strike to make sure that we understood their point of view. They were concerned that perhaps the auditor just doesn't really understand how these things work, that remember, there's this preconceived idea among certain people that all tax breaks and all business incentives are bad, and so how are you going to look good in an audit done by people who view it that way? And they're very heavy, as Robert says, on the point that these incentives are not paid out up front. They're paid out after the fact, after you've performed. Well, of course, the question is then, how do you measure performance? And that's the big thing that the audit brought up, is that they're measuring performance differently than they said they were going to, differently than we thought they were going to, differently for one business than for another. I mean, they certainly don't want to be in a position where they give an incentive to a business, the business doesn't perform, or the business is, you know, kind of right at the cusp of whether or not it performed, and then it's incumbent on GOAD to say, well, you know, you didn't perform, we're not going to give you the incentive. Well, once that gets around the corporate universe, and Utah doesn't come through with the incentives it promised, even, you know, if maybe down in the details it shouldn't have, that's not going to look good for Utah.
Well, and one of the things they really emphasized in GOAD's response to the audit was that they need this. They need to be. They're competing for these companies. They're competing for companies like Adobe and Boeing and Procter and Gamble and Goldman Sachs that have come in and created these jobs. And they need to be able to have the latitude and the flexibility. They can't have their hands tied when they're going out and competing with, you know, Colorado or New Mexico or whatever states are trying to attract these businesses. So they need their claim is that they need this flexibility. And if you start tying their hands, you're going to start losing these companies to other states that have more latitude.
And one thing I don't think it did come up in the meeting, but then this is what I think could reasonably referred to as corporate welfare. If you would propose a program for welfare for real people, for poor people, that's this loose and this subject to interpretation, and this that would allow this much freedom among the bureaucrats who administer it, would the legislature stand for that? I don't think so.
They would say
these people need oversight. Rich people, no, they don't need oversight. We need to bring them in. You know, Goldman Sachs, if you listen to This American Life on this station, you know what Goldman Sachs has been up to. And, you know, is that really the kind of company that we want to attract? Although it's certainly non-polluting, doesn't add to the carbon footprint, and neither does Adobe or eBay or companies like that that are the kind of things you want to attract and the kind of things that respond to this kind of inducement.
I think what George is suggesting is they do drug testing for Goldman Sachs like they do for welfare recipients.
There you go. Yeah, of course, there'll be different drugs probably that they'd find, but more expensive ones. But yeah, I think, and there's also been a suggestion that even legislators maybe should be subjected to drug tests, maybe just during the session.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things that the auditors suggest is that maybe if you give different companies different deals, that might open up the state to lawsuits. Is that possible?
Yeah. Well, they said that you need to have clear guidelines and treat everybody the same to make sure that there's not favoritism and that there's not potential liability on the backside. I don't remember them specifically talking about lawsuits, but they do. You know, there are opportunities for companies to make allegations that, oh, you played favorites with this company over that company, and frankly, GOAD was kind of acknowledging that one of the things that they really were trying to hit hard was bringing in the technology companies, like George mentioned, the eBays and the Overstocks and the Adobe and companies like that. They wanted to create that technology corridor, so they used their flexibility to kind of try to ramp up the incentives that were going to those companies and trying to bring those in particular.
Okay, well, we're going to have to take a quick break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW. You can join us. The number is 801-355-TALK, or send us a tweet to hashtag TribTalk. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Ryan Cunningham, filling in for Jennifer Napier-Pierce. And joining me today are reporters Robert Gerke and Matt Canham, education editor Rebecca
Welsh.
Thank you. First-time guest, so I'm a little rusty on your name. And editorial writer George Pyle from the Salt Lake Tribune. We're talking about the week's top stories, and you can join us by sending a tweet to hashtag TribTalk. putting your comments on sltrib.com, or calling us at 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. Let's get into maybe the biggest story of the week for Utah. Rebecca, a lot of controversy up in Logan this week, and it all started with a threat against a feminist critic of video games who was scheduled to speak on campus there at Utah State. What happened?
Well, I'm not sure Utah State really realized what they were getting into when they invited Anita Sarkeesian. She's a well-known feminist critic of video game culture and the representations of women in video games. She was invited. I think it took a while for the gaming community to realize she was coming, and she routinely gets death threats. So those death threats finally trickled into Utah State Monday night about 10 o'clock. They started looking at it, had their tech people review it, and decided it was serious, and then started to contact her on Tuesday when she was in transit to Salt Lake.
Okay, so this might be a question that a lot of people are wondering. Who is Anita Sarkeesian? Because no one really knew. Unless you're in the gaming world, you didn't really
know who Anita
Sarkeesian was.
She is a video blogger who has taken on video game culture from a feminist perspective and criticized the sort of dichotomy of victim-whore representations and the misogyny within the gaming community in general, the people who game, who push back against feminist critique of the games themselves. So she and several other feminist critics have been targeted for death threats. They've had their photos and addresses posted online. They've some of them have gone into hiding periodically. And so she had released her latest installment in her video blog and was, I think, coming to Utah to speak about it. But the death threat came. She was in the air. By the time she landed, another threat had come in. And she was starting to talk to the university about, well, can you do something about this? Can you keep... The university informed her, well, concealed weapons law in Utah allows concealed weapons on campus. We can't stop that from happening. We won't allow backpacks. She asked for pat-downs and metal detectors. They said, we can't do that. And so she reassessed and decided it wasn't safe and stayed in the airport and went back home.
So tell me a little bit about these threats. How bad were they? How many were there? Give me a sense of what they were like.
I'm aware of two. One was a fairly vile email from a person claiming to be a Utah State student whose life had been ruined by feminists, and he was going to kill her and other feminists on campus if the speech went forward. He compared it to the Montreal massacre of 1989, when 14 women were killed in the engineering department of a university up there.
Right.
The second, I think, was a more specific Gamergate.
Yeah, that's threat. A movement on Twitter and just on the internet in general. Can you describe what Gamergate is?
Gamergate started out as it was ostensibly about ethics in journalism. People targeted a particular gamer for having a relationship with a game journalist and said she shouldn't have this relationship. He's not unbiased. She's not unbiased. It then evolved into this group that calls itself Gamergate that goes after feminist critics of the culture of gaming.
Okay, and one of their targets has happened to be Anita Sarkeesian in the past, is that right?
Yes, and Zoe Quinn, that gamer who had the relationship with a journalist, I think that's correct.
Okay, where it all started.
So the second threat came from someone claiming to be part of Gamergate, and Gamergate routinely uses threats of violence to try to silence these women.
So the issue really, Sarkeesian said that the threats themselves weren't really why she canceled the event. It was more the security that was being offered at Utah State. She wasn't pleased with how Utah State officials were dealing with that.
Yeah, she pointed out that she spoke at Geek Girl Con in Seattle over the weekend despite getting death threats, but that's because they could stop guns from coming in to the venue. Utah State repeatedly said, we can't do anything about this. We can't stop concealed weapon carriers from coming in. We'll have extra staff. We won't allow backpacks. We'll try to do what we can. We assure you that we think it's safe, that there's no risk. But she was not convinced. And she's actually said she will not speak at a Utah university as long as concealed weapons are allowed in the venue.
So there was a legislator, a Utah legislator, who had some comments about this as well. Kurt Oda, who's a pro-gun advocate in the legislature, historically speaking. Robert, tell us about what Representative Kurt Oda said in reaction to this story.
Well, this Kurt has had sort of, it's been an issue for him for a long time, the guns on campus issue, and whether they have to be concealed or not, you know, and this goes back several years. There was actually a hearing on it. There happened to be a hearing on it up at the legislature this week, and his point, he said, I think, that she was overreacting,
yes.
That the people who have concealed weapons permits are generally law-abiding citizens, and that she shouldn't take this death threat so personally.
That they're good guys.
That they're good guys.
And you shouldn't limit the good guys.
Yeah, and he's said in the past that, you know, you want people who are armed there to provide, you know, to defend themselves and defend others there. So, you know, and that's sort of distilled down. That's sort of the crux of the debate about weapons on campus, I think. Are you safer with more people who might be armed, or are you safer with people not being armed? And it's the same thing we've seen played out over the years, and every time it seems like that there's a mass shooting, you know. But yeah, that was the thrust of Kurt's statement, was that, you know, she's just overreacting, and these concealed weapon holders are there for, they make it safer rather than more dangerous.
Okay, yeah,
go
ahead.
And she pushed back and said that's essentially calling her a hysterical female, that was a sexist comment in and of itself to say that a person who routinely receives death threats was overreacting by saying, I'm not going to put myself in front of a room with people carrying guns.
So I have to throw this to George Pyle. What is your reaction to that argument? Is that valid?
Well, for one thing, I mean, the editorial board is made up of old white men, so we don't know anything about Gamergate or any of this stuff. But we do know a lot about Utah firearms laws. We've been following that for a long time. Our position for a long time has been that universities, schools, anybody should be able to make their own decisions about where guns are or are not allowed and are or are not an advantage or a disadvantage. The editorial board's position is that the idea that more guns means more safety is a pathology that in future will be recognized as such, that the idea that if you have 15 people in an auditorium with guns and somebody pulls out a gun and then everybody else pulls out a gun and everybody starts shooting, I mean, people who think that more guns make more safety have watched way too many movies and probably play too many video games. And when an ambassador from the 21st century makes an appointment to speak in Utah, finds out what our laws are, and turns around at the airport and leaves, that makes Utah look really, really bad. I mean, on the same day they're having this, how are we going to attract business to come here? What kind of incentives do we want to provide? You know, well, you could drop the kitchen case and recognize gay marriage. You could do away with these laws that allow anybody to have a concealed carry permit with no range training, not the slightest bit of proof that you actually know how to handle a firearm. You know, you could do away with those 19th century views of the world, and maybe the modern high-tech companies that you want to attract would view Utah in a more favorable light.
Just a reminder, you're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. If you'd like to join in on conversation, give us a call at 801-355-TALK or tweet us at #TribTalk. Rebecca, I'm wondering, how are students up in Logan at Utah State University reacting to all this?
I think the student community was fairly consistent in backing up her right to speak, and they were upset that the speech had been sort of hijacked by these threats. Some students said they thought it was a hoax and that she should have gone forward with it, but plenty of people said, you know, if she feels that her life is at risk, she doesn't have to speak. But they were angry that free speech was sort of curtailed by these anonymous threats from people who may or may not even be in Utah.
Have officials up there, have they been fairly consistent in backing up how they felt like they should have reacted to these threats?
They have consistently said that they thought that they had created a safe venue for her within the framework of Utah's concealed weapons laws, and they have defended their response. One question some people have raised is, why couldn't the legislature provide an emergency exception if you do get death threats on a campus that you could put in special protections for that person? It's worth noting that Utah State allowed concealed weapons into the speeches of Supreme Court Justice Scalia and actor Danny Glover, who both had received threats. People were allowed to carry their weapons into those speeches. So they were trying to be consistent, but it does raise these questions. If you have someone who routinely receives death threats and may have to go in hiding, and wants to speak at the university, could you make an exception? It's worth noting also that Representative Oda wants to allow open carry on campuses. He believes that people should be able to carry their guns not concealed. He believes they should be more prominent on campus.
George Pyle, how does this make Utah look, this whole incident? Because it's blown up. It's a national incident. Yeah. Anita Sarkeesian has been on national news outlets now.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, you're on the front page of the New York Times saying, it says, you know, she doesn't speak in Utah because of death threats. And it's all over. You go on Google News and you just search Utah. And the first thing that comes up is this case and the fact that she spoke in Seattle, she spoke in California, she spoke in all these other places. Where was it too dangerous to speak? Utah. And, you know, it's the momentary fluster of the news cycle, and it will pass. But, you know, Jennifer had a guest from the University of Utah on a Trib Talk yesterday, and he boiled it down to one sentence. Violence kills free speech. It would have been nice for people to sit down and have a conversation about the nature of video games, whether they're truly damaging or whether they're just harmless fantasy, whether women are treated in a way in video games that really harms real live women, or whether, you know, it's just a game, get over it, you know, have that kind of conversation back and forth. But now we couldn't have that conversation because a credible threat of violence was issued in an environment where the state has ruled that more guns are good. Well, people from the rest of the world don't think that, unless maybe Somalia. And if that's your model, you know, then that's fine. But, you know, it makes Utah look awful.
George Pyle comparing Utah to Somalia today behind the headlines. Oh, it'll be interesting.
Smells better. But. Yeah.
It'll be interesting to see how other speakers react to Anita's call to action for the boycott, to see if less speakers do come to Utah as a result of this. Let's move on to the midterm election, lest we forget there is a midterm election going on in a few weeks, actually. There was a debate this week between Mia Love and Doug Owens for the 4th District Congressional seat. They met on stage on KUED Studios, which is actually in the 2nd Congressional District, I think.
Yes, it is.
It's hard to tell around here.
Education was kind of a highlighted topic in the debate. Let's talk about the role of federal role of education. What did the two candidates have to say about that, Matt?
Yeah, this is the one issue where they disagreed on most. Republican Mia Love says she wants to give the decision-making from Washington to states as much as possible. And when we're talking about education on the federal level, that would be funding for Title I schools, special education, mostly those kind of things. She also is a critic of Common Core standards, which she believes is tied to the federal government, though our attorney general in the state of Utah disagrees. And there does not appear to be much tied to the federal government since it was created by states. Her Democratic opponent, Doug Owens, he wants to use the federal government as a way to boost funding for education. He wants to increase the amount of money that comes to states for public education, for higher education. He also wants to come up with new incentives to hire STEM educators, which would be science, engineering, technology.
Math.
Thank you. Yes. Good job, team. and so that's, he has this different role. And when you look at it, it's the way a Democrat would look at it and the way a Republican would look at it. But Owens adds a wrinkle to it that he's very critical of past statements Mia Love has made calling for the actual elimination of the Department of Education and for the elimination of federally backed student loans. On both of those points, Mia Love says that that's not what she said, even though that is what she has said. and that's the fight that we've had this week, is how she's, you know, looks at, you know, what happened there on the federally backed student loans is she put out a mailer in 2012 that had a list of ideas for cuts that she called her initial plan. She now says that was just a list of ideas and not a plan. And on the Department of Education, she now says that she doesn't necessarily want to get rid of it. She wants to make the salaries of the bureaucrats in Washington the same as the teachers here in Utah, which it's not going to happen, but that's her current position on the Department of Education.
So education, a big issue. Also, healthcare and immigration were also big sticking points between the two candidates.
That's a little bit more subtle. On healthcare, they're both critics of the Affordable Care Act. The difference is that Mia Love would still try to repeal it completely, and that Doug says that that is a futile position and that it needs to be fixed, and that there's parts that we should like and there's parts we should get rid of. In particular, he wants to decouple health care from your job. He thinks that that is creates poor incentives. She wants to start over again and have a more free market system when it comes to health care, where you can buy it and move it across state lines. On immigration, they both actually have a lot of agreement on what needs to happen. It's depending on what order it happens in. Doug Owens wants to do comprehensive immigration reform now, similar to a bill that passed the Senate last year. She wants to do what the House does in a piecemeal fashion. Though she has said to the Tribune editorial board that she does support a pathway to citizenship eventually. She just doesn't want to do that in the first, second, or third step of immigration reform.
What was the overall tone of this debate? Was it what you were expecting?
It wasn't. I expected it to be more confrontational. Doug Owens is a corporate defense attorney by trade. He argues in public for a living. I assumed that in this debate, because he's down in the polls, that he would take the fight to Mia Love more. Mia Love, the way she approached it, her posture is that she's going to try to stay above the fray and then be critical of critique from Doug Owens. She did claim that he had negative attacks by pointing out her past education positions. I asked Doug afterward why he wasn't more confrontational. And he said it's just not him personally, and he also had a fear that he did not want to look like the angry guy trying to, you know, beat up on his opponent.
Well, she kind of did an interesting thing early on, too, where she talked about, you know, let's not attack people, let's come to solutions. That was sort of, even in her, I believe, in her opening statement.
Yes.
And that sort of took the sword out of Doug's hand, I think, because then anything that he did to kind of go after her on any of the positions was seen as an attack, and she could just point to that and say, ah, see, he's attacking me, just like I said he would.
Right. It did put him on the defensive. And the questions after the debate were, well, why did you attack? And he's saying, I pointed out differences in policy positions. Those should be legitimate in a public policy debate.
Yeah.
So
it's hard to debate without disagreeing on things. Although they did a pretty good job of it.
George, your column is called State of the Debate. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to consider you the expert here. How did the Utah Debate Commission do in this first round of debates, this first try?
Well, it would have been nice if we'd had more, but especially in maybe in this race where this is a non-incumbent race, Jim Matheson stepping down. But, you know, incumbents or those who are in the lead don't want any more debates than they can get away with because they want to keep their lead. If you're in the lead and you speak in public, especially in a debate situation, every time you answer a question, you increase the odds that you'll say something stupid or something that sounds stupid. And so you don't want to squander that lead. Challengers and those who are down in the polls want more debates because they need the exposure. They don't have as much money to buy commercials and buy newspaper ads. So this is their free media. This is their earned media that they get. You can always quibble about the format. You know, how much can you really say in 90 seconds? Should you let the candidates go at each other more without the moderator? Should you have one moderator? Should you have a panel? Should you take questions from the audience? Should you take questions off the internet? Who's going to screen those questions? There's a zillion different ways you can do it. The public has a limited attention span, unfortunately. And so I think overall, if you're going to have debates, and especially if you're only going to have one per race, I think they handled it pretty well. And I think all the candidates acquitted themselves rather well.
I don't know. Matt and I have covered a lot of these debates, and I thought this year with the debate commission format, it gave candidates a cover for not debating more. They could say, oh, look, we're going to do the one debate, but the debate commission says we should do. We're not going to do any others. I mean, 2 years ago, we saw Mia Love and Jim Matheson debate 4 or 5 times, depending on how you count it. This year, they could just say, well, we're only going to do the one. And I think the format kind of limited their ability to interact with each other and, you know, engage with each other. You know, these 90-second statements moving one issue to the other, there was no engagement between the candidates. And I think when we saw 4 years ago, you see different issues handled differently in the, as the debates move on. And I think that's valuable, too. I think the commission just kind of gave the candidates cover to not do that. And I don't know that that necessarily benefits the voters.
Love and Owens will be debating again on the Doug Wright Show on KSL, though. So there'll be one more debate for those two candidates.
I'm sure it'll be hard-hitting.
Yeah. Well, and the debate they did have, I mean, these are on the Utah Debate Commission site. So if you missed it, you can still go see it. That's not as good as having more debates with more questions and different moderators. But it's not just a situation like you know, the original Kennedy-Nixon debate. If you missed it, it was gone. And these are online for people to have a look at and go back over. But, yeah, more debates in circumstances. People get tired of me talking about what they do in Kansas all the time. But in Kansas, at the state fair every year, they have a debate and the two candidates go at each other for like 90 minutes. The moderator opens and closes, and other than that, they speak and they ask each other questions. And that can get a little raucous sometimes, but sometimes you can take the measure of people a little better under that circumstance.
I find it interesting covering politics in Utah that there's often a perception that any sort of criticism of each other is negative campaigning and that Utahns don't like that. And I don't know exactly where that came from or how that, you know, how you judge that, because you know, if you look at the last race between Mia Love and Jim Matheson, there was all kinds of negative campaigning, and clearly both candidates from both parties thought that would work. So I think some of that direct back and forth would be great.
We're going to have to take a quick break. 801-355-TALK is the number to call if you have any comments, or hashtag TribTalk on Twitter. Stay with us. And welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Ryan Cunningham. Joining me in the studio from the opinion side, George Pyle. On the reporting side, Matt Canham, Robert Gerke, and education editor Rebecca Walsh. You're welcome to join us as well at 801-355-TALK for your comments on sltrib.com or send us a tweet at hashtag TribTalk. We do have a caller right now. It's Matt from West Jordan. Thanks for joining us, Matt.
Oh, it's Mike. But
oh, Mike. Thank you.
That's no problem. Names, it's with them, right?
Yeah, exactly. So what was your question?
Well, it was more of a comment. I was listening to the debate on the Anita Sarkeesian episode up at Utah State. Kind of the insinuation that because people are allowed to carry a concealed weapon into that scenario, that, you know, Ms. Sarkeesian decided to back out. I always hear, and you hear it in the media all the time about these Wild West scenarios, about what's going to happen, if something were to, if a crime or something was to happen in there and you've got a bunch of people pulling guns. But nationally, that has never happened. And I think it's wrong for the media to continually, put that hypothetical out there, because it just hasn't played out. And the other thing to go along with that is that, Utah doesn't allow or doesn't require a range, range time for a concealed carry permit, and I disagree with that. I think they should, but the people that are not in favor of concealed carry and see it as a threat, if Utah were to actually require a range requirement, would that opinion change? I really don't think it would, but I would like to know, maybe from Mr. Pyle or one of your other commentators, if that would really change. Would they have a different view on what happened at Utah State if those people had been required to take range time?
Well, if range time, actually holding a firearm and shooting it someplace, you would think that would be a minimal requirement of being allowed to carry a weapon. And the fact that it isn't indicates to us that the Utah legislature really doesn't want there to be any requirements. It wants everybody to carry a gun. They have this idea that more guns makes us safer, which is pathological. And so if they would require a range test, at least there would be a little bit of a political cover that we think that we're making people safer by putting trained concealed carry permit holders out into the community where they can defend themselves and others. That would help, but the idea that a person from the 21st century comes to Utah, is told that even under the cloud of a credible death threat, not just to her, but to the contents of the whole auditorium and anybody else that might be wandering by, which was the nature of the threat, that they don't, that the university doesn't have the power to say, okay, under these circumstances, we're going to ban firearms from this building, just today, for these circumstances. And their interpretation, their reasonable interpretation of the way state law is written, is they couldn't even do that. And that is why people from the rest of the country and the rest of the civilized world look down at us. And I'm not going to compare us to Dodge City because my brother lives in Dodge City, but it makes us look bad.
I think, you know, the fact that Utah doesn't have a range time requirement is one of the reasons that states like, I think, Nevada and New Mexico and a few others don't recognize Utah concealed weapons permits. It is recognized in most states, but there are some that say, well, you don't have a range time requirement. We're not going to recognize it. Mike raises a valid point, though, that, you know, the issue is not necessarily whether these concealed weapons permits holders at the Anita Sarkeesian event have range time or not. It's the question of whether or not the guns should have been allowed there in the first place, or whether constitutionally the state has the authority to prevent them from being there.
Yeah, and the legislature could tweak the law. They won't, but they very easily could say, okay, we think that the Second Amendment says people get to carry guns, and we think that our permit process is enough that we know who they are and they have a criminal background check and they have a little bit of training, and we think that's enough. Okay, fine. But the fact that they preempt university professors, university police chiefs, university security experts from saying, you know, in this venue, under these circumstances, I don't think so. They don't even have that right under Utah law, and I think it would be perfectly reasonable for the legislature to say that sworn law enforcement, people who are responsible for the safety of the public in an atmosphere, especially a university, where by their nature people are going to stand up and say provocative things, and they have to feel that they are going to be able to say provocative things in an atmosphere where it would be officially frowned on if anybody shot them.
Well, Mike, thank you so much for your call.
Maybe just one other question real quick, and then I'll let you guys discuss it or move on to a different subject. And I get the points that people are making. I think it's just wrong that, you know, the concealed carry permit holders that were going into that auditorium or were going to before it was canceled, they're being made to look like the bad guys. It's not the people that are out there trying to actively harm or hurt person. You know, the person that made the threat, who knows who that person was? He could have been some guy in his basement in his pajamas in California that just didn't like the lady. But instead, the media makes it look like because concealed carry permit holders are allowed to bring their firearms, which they are legally and licensed, you know, to own, they're the bad guys, and they should not be the bad guys.
Well, it did make the difference. You can call them bad guys or good guys, but there is no question that it was what made the difference. And if the media doesn't report that, then it's not telling you the whole story.
Rebecca Walsh, did you have a comment on that?
Yeah, I would push back a little bit. I don't think we were the ones making the issue about the concealed weapon carriers. I think Anita Sarkeesian had the concern about all of the number of guns that could have been in the room. And I would also like to point out that we don't know what Anita Sarkeesian's life is like. I'm not someone who gets death threats every day, depending on where I'm going in the world. Anita Sarkeesian does. And so it's up to her to decide what's safe and what's not.
Okay. Mike, thank you so much.
Hey, thank you.
We also had a comment from Gwen on the SLTrib.com website. She seemed to be under the impression that without a screen for guns at the auditorium where the presentation was going to occur, just anyone could have carried a gun into the auditorium freely, not just people with concealed guns weapons. Is that true?
Yeah, that's right. Under Utah's law, you can open carry a firearm as long as there's two motions to fire the gun. So that means pumping around in the chamber and pulling the trigger. So you can open carry anywhere in an event like that. So it's not just a matter of concealed weapons in Utah. It's also this open carry law that has existed for quite some time.
I think what they're trying to say, though, too, is that because you're not checking for guns, because people who can have a concealed weapon can carry it,
Right. Then
anyone can carry a gun in there. That because you're not actually screening for guns in the first place, you don't actually have to have a concealed carry permit to bring a gun into that room.
And she asked that they screen for concealed weapon permits. She said, well, can you make sure that everyone who does have a gun has a concealed weapon permit? And the university declined to do that, thinking that that was too onerous for concealed weapon carriers.
It also kind of defeats the purpose of the concealed part.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, if you're supposed to get a permit, but then even people who don't have permits can carry guns anywhere they want because they might have a permit, then what's the point of requiring permits? Of course, it's just window dressing, and we all know that.
And then back to the Mia Love Doug Owens debate, we have an anonymous comment. Someone just thought that Mia Love might be taking some of the attacks on her positions too personally. I don't know if that's anything you guys want to comment
on. I think that, you know, when you look at politics and you have to look at the posture of each candidate, she is in the lead right now from every single poll. And it seems to be, you know, I think Doug Owens has made some ground, but she's still in the lead. So she has to say, how do I keep my lead? Well, my opponent might attack me. So one of my best strategies is to fight back on the attacks by saying he's being negative, he's giving negative attacks. And under that scenario, I think whatever criticism Doug Owens had of Mia Love, that was going to be her response.
And I find the gender component of that interesting. A woman saying that someone is attacking her shuts down the debate immediately.
Has been a theme this week, it sounds like.
Yeah, it is an issue, and it was an issue in 2012. How do you criticize a female candidate in a debate format? You know, do you look like a bully if you go after her too hard? And I think, like Matt said, I think it kind of takes the sword out of Doug Owens' hands in a lot of ways to say, okay, well, he's going to attack me. Look, he's attacking me. And you know, so you know, I mean, politics is, it's not tiddlywinks. It's not, you know, it's not touch football. So it's supposed to be engaging on these types of debate, on these types of issues. And that's, I think, to be expected.
It would be nice if both candidates and observers could tell the difference between disagreeing with a position and attacking a person's character.
All right. We are running short of time here. I want to get to our underplayed stories of the week. We'll just go around the table. This is where we talk about one of the stories that you might have missed and you should probably know about. We'll start with Rebecca, the newbie.
Well, I read this as underplayed in the Tribune. I wish that we had been able to put the Gamergate story on the front page. If you haven't had a chance to read it, it's a fascinating debate nationally. And as you saw at Utah State, the debate gets shut down routinely when threats come out. So you may have to read some of the background to really understand what's behind this. Hopefully, debate will continue and these women will be allowed to say what they say, and then someone will engage them in a more constructive way. But it's a fascinating story to follow.
All right, Gamergate. Robert, go ahead.
I think one that is relevant this week, because we're setting our clocks back Sunday, is the daylight savings time legislation. During the interim session, there was discussion about whether to do away with daylight savings and go with, like Arizona does. There's going to be a bill this session to do that. It might be on the ballot in 2016. And so, you know, that's something that will affect everybody, I think, in the state if they go that route.
Okay. George?
This is about as far from Utah as you can get. I just read coming in on the BBC that they've made a deal to free the schoolgirls that were kidnapped by Boko Haram in Africa. If that's true, that's what they say on the web. Interesting if true. That's big news.
Very big news. Okay. And Matt?
The Utah State Fairgrounds and the future of it is an interesting story. Last year, the fair did not do well at all. Part of it was weather-based. This year, they had more than 300,000 visitors, made $800,000, and the fair organizers and people who operate the fair are saying, you know, we're saved. At the same time, there's this backstory of maybe putting a minor league soccer stadium in there, and the future of what happens in the fairgrounds will be interesting to watch.
Yeah, I'm actually, as a soccer fan, I'm actually kind of excited about that. Jennifer picked this story for me. It's actually this wonderful piece by Benjamin Wood, but I have my own underplayed story. I feel like baseball is always an underplayed story in Utah. The Kansas City Royals are going to be in the World Series. We have a Kansas City Royals fan
here.
I
was born 5 blocks away from the old stadium.
There you go. So it's the first time they've been in the World Series since 1985. They have not lost yet in this postseason, which means, and this is going to make everyone here feel old, the Kansas City Royals are yet to lose a postseason game in my lifetime.
Yes. And so in the player's lifetime.
So that is my underplayed story of the week. I want to thank all of my expert reporters here today. Rebecca Walsh, George Pyle, Robert Gerke, and Matt Cannon of the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks very much to all of you for coming in and tolerating me today.
No problem.
Thanks. Have a good weekend.
Thank you. Jennifer Napier-Pierce will be back next week. We'll wrap up this week with a Tribune columnist, Robert Kirby. This week, Kirby offers us a tribute to ketchup.
Yeah, I mean, we've all been forced to use certain things to help us get the food down that we don't like. I can't eat broccoli at all, but if I'm given some other vegetables like Brussels sprouts, it better have a lot of cheese on it for me to get it down. And you learn this as a kid, you know. Mix it with other foods or cover it with a sauce, and maybe you can get it all the way down to your stomach.
This particular column I thought was true artistry. How many people can write about condiments for 600 words?
Only the mentally ill can do that. The truly obsessed. But I just came across this article one day on the evolution of ketchup in America and how it's been for years and years the number one condiment in America, but it's rapidly being overtaken by salsa.
Mm.
You know, so our kids are going to grow up not knowing what ketchup is or was and have their own for a long, you know, that they'll relate to. In this column I wrote back in 2010, I said that in America, king of the condiments is ketchup. Big Red gets dumped on everything, including fries, meatloaf, hamburgers, scrambled eggs, hot dogs, wedding cake, turnips, and even lacerations. Hey, a lot of people don't know that ketchup was originally intended as a medicine. During the 1830s, it was marketed as Dr. Miles' compound extract of tomato, apparently just the thing for mumps, typhus, and female trouble. Early forms of ketchup contained everything from anchovies to pickles. The flavors varied, as you can well imagine, but the main ingredient has always been tomatoes, which everyone knows, I didn't until 5 minutes ago, contain a high amount of lycopene, an antioxidant normally found in bathroom cleaners. Mainly, though, ketchup was a godsend to housewives who used it to spruce up leftovers and otherwise dull meals, thereby getting nutrition into picky children. Ketchup kept America strong.
Well, what are we going to do if salsa takes over this American institution?
Yeah, I mean, we'll just do what we did, what we've always done, and that's change to meet the needs. I mean, the Southwest influence in America is growing stronger all the time, and salsa, probably a little more healthy for you than what ketchup has finally become, which is just pureed sugar and tomatoes.
But doesn't it taste good?
Yeah, it does taste good. Can't have meatloaf without it.
Thanks for listening to Behind the Headlines. I'm Ryan Cunningham. Have a great weekend.